Hello everyone, welcome to the Local Shop Podcast. This is the second in a three-part series from this year's Heart of the Community Conference, featuring a live panel discussion on the importance of services in the convenience sector, including areas like deposit return schemes and access to cash. The panel is made up of James Daly from Fairer Finance, Richard Piggin from Which, Steve O'Neill from Paypoint, and Linda Williams, an award-winning independent retailer from Edinburgh.
So Steve's after the question. Away you go. Answer Steve's questions. No, slightly dive into that. Linda, I want to start with you. The services you're offering in your sort of your premier store, South Edinburgh. Tell us about the services you offer and how that's changed over the last few years.
We're very fortunate in that we still have a free-to-use ATM, but we've been studying the contract and they can change that at any time, so we're just hoping they'll just ignore us quietly.
Unfortunately, going on a panel talking about that.
We have quite a popular parcel service, collection and drop-off, and that has grown drastically. That's really quite a good money spinner, even with the cuts in commission that there have been recently. And it is a good footfall driver. Although with all of these things, the footfall driver, it's always very, very hard to convert them into cash-paying customers.
Yeah.
And that is the ultimate challenge. And then, of course, most recently, we did a trial of a reverse vending machine, which I think is what I'm here to talk about today.
Well, not all these things, but that's certainly something we want to come on to. So we'll save that because that's a really important issue. Example of a new service that's going to be offered in many more stores. So that's from a retailer point of view, the type of offer you come up with. Richard, I'm going to come to you now talking about the services that consumers want. You know, as we see lots of changes in banks, in lots of the services, maybe traditionally accessed through a separate unit on the high street or in a parade, as those numbers maybe have declined, what are consumers looking for in terms of access, local access to services?
Yep, so what do consumers want? What factors are important to consumers? We always say this, there are four predominantly. Price, I mean, lots of this will be obvious to you. Price, choice, quality, convenience. Now, we haven't looked at, you know, exactly the type of services that consumers want from a convenience store when we've looked at convenience stores in the past. We've more focused on the range of products, the store appearance, queuing times, some of the customer service levels that are important to consumers. But we've recently looked at what sort of types of services or shops are thriving in a local community, thriving on the high street, and which ones are disappearing. And again, probably not surprisingly, the ones that are disappearing are the ones, the types of services that are being overtaken by digital, by the online world. The number of bookshops is probably the classic example if you look at how many bookshops there were on the high street recently compared to how many there are now. The ones that are thriving are ones that are being driven by personal services and a level of personal customer service that can't be replicated online and offer that convenience in a local area. So the types of services that you see, and I'm not suggesting that these should be incorporated in convenience stores, but the types of services, to give you an example, are hairdressers, barbers, tattoo parlours, because they're things that can't be replicated online. And we've seen a boom of them in the local high street. The convenience store from the consumer perspective, you know, what can it provide from an everyday needs, that convenience side of things? And one of the things that I think James is going to talk about, you know, strongly is access to everyday banking services that people want in their local community and communities that have been ripped apart by bank branch closures and ATM closures. And people still do rely on cash. And we'll talk about the types of people that might rely on cash, the types of people that want to use cash. Come back to that point around choice. And so, you know, I would say the free-to-use ATM, the ability to access cash in their local area is a significant, important factor for consumers.
Yeah, thank you. And James, actually, to build on that. So I suppose looking at it from a point of view in terms of Fairer Finance and the work you do, thinking from what consumers need of financial institutions, financial services, and then what role our members can play in matching up those needs and that service provision. What do you see as the future?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I'm here mostly in my capacity as a member of the Access to Cash Review that reported earlier this year. And the reason that independent group came together was because it was clear there was a rapid decline in cash usage across the country as a whole, and that was having lots of implications for the future sustainability of the whole cash network. And we already saw links starting to reduce interchange fees And if we carried on the direction of travel that we were on, we would very quickly end up in a cashless society where lots of consumers still absolutely rely on cash and need it to survive. And so what we were looking at as a review group was, how can we slow that down, and what conditions do we need to even consider whether we are willing to go cashless? And of course, you know, what we discovered is there are still millions of people who rely on it at a time bank branches are closing, ATMs are starting to charge, many of them in your shops, and that, you know, there is still this great demand for it, particularly from consumers in rural communities where there's less access to bank branches and ATMs, elderly consumers, consumers with disabilities who rely on cash because they can't engage with digital payment systems. And so we came up with a slate of recommendations to try and slow things down. And in the short term, the kind of nub of that was, we need to protect cash because we are not ready to go cashless as a society. And if we're going to do that, we need to firstly protect access to it and make sure consumers can get their hands on it for free. And you know, that is going to need some joined up work from government. But convenience stores have, I think, hopefully an important part to play in that if they want to. But then the other part is, you know, ensuring that stores continue to accept it. And the quid pro quo has to be that cash is not too expensive. And some of the reasons that stores are starting to stop accepting cash are mitigated. You know, we've seen costs of depositing cash creeping up over the last few years for small businesses. Lots of businesses stop using it because of security concerns. You know, I think those are problems that can be solved. But we need some kind of joined-up thinking from government and regulators to get there.
I want to pick up on those specific points about cash, and it's one of the main topics for this discussion. But firstly, come to Steve. So in terms of retailers accessing services, in our sector, well, more than through any other platform, they'll be accessing that through the PayPoint platform, so what you provide. How's that changed, and how do you see that changing in the future in terms of the mix of services that are available?
So I think it's interesting, if you sort of wind back to the mid-90s, the concept of paying a bill in a local shop just didn't exist. So that just wasn't a thing. So you only have to kind of then sort of accelerate through in terms of the range of things that you can do today, and you've still got the utilities and sort of, you know, all the kind of classic sort of, you know, kind of, I guess, essentials, as you call them, for kind of consumers in local communities across the UK. But then we work with brands like Amazon and eBay and PlayStation. So there's a kind of digital sort of group of brands that are needing to find a way to access those consumers. So they see it as a growth opportunity, actually, because actually they can't access those consumers because they can't go to the Amazon website, they can't go onto the PlayStation network to buy content. And similarly, on the banking front, we've seen some of the challenger banks, so people like Monzo, who kind of have come to the market to kind of challenge the sort of traditional model of banking, initially kind of launching, saying, we don't need branches, they're too expensive, everyone's closing them, and then kind of going, actually, our consumers do want to be able to deposit cash somewhere. So we're doing some work with that. I know the post office do similar with Starling. So I think there's a kind of an interesting sort of digital sort of realm that certainly through the numbers that we're seeing has kind of grown quite considerably over the last two years or so. Now, where it kind of leads to, just in terms of sort of what does the crystal ball say right now, I think fundamentally it always comes down to, we've always kind of focused on things that are essential, fundamentally. Now, what is essential to me will be different to everybody in this room. For some people, that could mean keeping the heating on and the lights on. For other people, that could be, I need to get the next player in FIFA 20 because that's what I'm doing and I'm 14 and I want to sort of buy that. So actually, I think the game that we have to play is really about sort of seeing what are those essentials that kind of could be. I always look to my kids as a sort of, you know, I've got an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old. I don't really understand their lives. But actually kind of those are the people that we need to be thinking of to really have a kind of sense of kind of what future services are they going to expect when they start sort of earning, hopefully sooner than rather than later, and actually kind of where they're going to be sort of consumers and really kind of using some of the services that exist across the UK.
That's really interesting. I want to pick up on that with Richard, because in terms, we often talk about access to cash and access to some of these services as being legacy services almost, and being particularly associated with older customers, often the way we talk about them. But as Steve says there, not necessarily the case. And you know, Monzo is certainly an example of where, you know, that is a youth-targeted brand, isn't it? A young people-targeted brand. And yet we're providing part of the matrix of services to those people. What are the services, I suppose, which older people are most going to need from us going forward that they're not going to want to lose? What are the new services that younger customers are saying to which that they're going to want more of in the future?
So in terms of financial services, again, we've just done a piece of work on this that's looking at, you know, how do people use their, you know, everyday finances. And increasingly, they view retail banking, everyday banking services, as a utility. It's not something they want to necessarily need to engage with. They don't necessarily won't switch all the time. They just see it that it needs to be there. The problem that we've got is that the approach to it isn't the same as an approach to a utility, because we've seen a disjointed approach to, you know, how consumers are able to access cash and what happens in the future. So banks decide to close branches independently of each other. ATM closures happen independently of that. Barclays makes a decision to withdraw from the post office. All of these factors are taken independently with nobody giving real oversight as to what consumers do need and how can you protect cash in the long term, which is what James is talking about. So in terms of those things, you know, if we're talking about everyday finances and just around cash, it's not just about accessing cash. It's about being able to deposit money. It's about able to make bill payments and have often a face-to-face or a conversation with somebody about their financial life. That's what people view as a utility, as essential. That's what we need to maintain and find some way to provide a guarantee that it can be sustained for as long as consumers need that. And obviously the way in which people use financial services, the way in which people make payments is changing. But as James said, we are far from being ready to go cashless. Consumers value choice. They want that choice over how to make payments, how to do their banking. Some will move towards Monzo. I think there are 5 million people who don't use cash, 1.9 million people who solely rely on cash. And that's not just the elderly. You talked about the elderly, but it's an easy assumption to make that it's just the elderly. But actually, when we talk to young people who use cash for budgeting reasons. Yeah. You know, you look at different user scenarios. We've had people talk to us. There's a young man with a sight impairment who prefers to use cash because he doesn't trust digital payments, because he can't quite see exactly what he's being charged for and what exactly he's paying. So there's lots of different user scenarios. And I think there will be technology to address and digital solutions to address those user scenarios, but we're so far away from seeing them and then so far away from the uptake of them that we can't move towards them yet.
Yeah. James, Richard raised a very interesting point there. It's not just about access in terms of the number of places in which you can access that service, but also the quality of the offering of that service. And the question's come through on Twitter. How do we increase the breadth of service provision, but do that how do we upskill colleagues to deliver those services really well? Or is it all about just administering a system which does it all for us? How do we make that work in stores and give people the quality of experience they want as well as the breadth and access?
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not much of a futurologist, but, you know, I guess you can see a world where convenience stores become the hub for all sorts of financial services. And at that point, we will have to think about, you know, who are the people administering those services. At the moment, it is quite binary. You know, it is simply about depositing and withdrawing and making payments and so on. But, you know, if we continue on this trend that we're on at the moment, we've seen, you know, I think it's Which's figures say we've seen 3,300 branches closed, bank branches closed over the last 4 years alone. You know, if we carry on that trajectory, you know, especially if the whole post office arrangement starts to fall apart, which Barclays could be sort of taking the first brick out of the wall in that as well, you know, who's going to be left to administer these essential services? It will be convenience stores. So, you know, there may be a point where, and perhaps not just a point that we need to wait for, an opportunity for the sector to embrace that, you know, and start to, you know, as Richard said, think about what are those essential services that a section of community will always want to do over the counter in a face-to-face interaction. Is there an opportunity for us today to seize that and be part of the solution?
I mean, Linda, as the operator on the panel, the theory is lovely.
Yes.
All these services struggle, we take them on, we offer this wonderful range of services to our customers. What are the practical training issues, issues in offering
this? The main issue is, if we're going to do all of these extra things, it has to be worth our while. Because at the end of the day, we are businesses, and we cannot do something just for the good of the community. We need to have something out. We've got wages to pay, we've got bills to pay, and there has to be something in it for us. And I would have slight concerns about responsibility, about financial services, about financial regulations. Mm-hmm. It is slightly worrying. And given the raft of legislation that we're currently having imposed on us, that is just a step too far for me at the moment. That I find that really quite frightening.
Yeah. And Steve, I mean, presumably, it's clearly, you know, people, if you buy something online and you get it delivered to your local shop, you're not going to pay for that. It's now the expectation is part of it. How do we square these things? Not just in terms of margin, definitely that sort of conversation right here, but in terms of upskilling people and the quality of that delivery and the practical issues in delivering those things. Things like parcel services where you've got space restrictions and so on. How far can we push this within the physical boundaries actually that we've got?
Yeah, I mean, I think the parcels piece is quite interesting. I mean, we all increasingly want more stuff and buy more stuff, but that stuff has to go somewhere.
Yeah.
So there's seas of vans and often cars now that are just swilling around the country, sort of getting people their stuff. Now, clearly, sort of in terms of from an environmental perspective, delivering to one store rather than 10 houses, environmentally, actually kind of is quite a good thing. In fact, certainly within London, I think it may well have been Sadiq Khan who sort of last year kind of said, oh, I think what would be a great idea would be to have like this network of local sort of pickup points. And we sort of stuck our hands up and kind of went, well, actually, that's sort of existed for about 10 years now. So I think that's a consideration. Clearly, the cost dynamics that sort of, you know, kick around that market around sort of, you know, kind of the expectations free delivery, often next day. And therefore, sort of, you know, kind of how can you really sort of, you know, kind of deliver that? I mean, from a practical perspective, we've started to kind of look at sort of how we can sort of operationally kind of reduce the burden. So we keep sort of adding more carriers and more sort of business into the network, which is a good thing, hopefully. But then actually kind of we're ultra aware that sort of operationally there's a consideration there. How do you make it easier for the retailer? How do you use sort of a range of different technologies to actually deliver that? Because quite frankly, when someone like Amazon or eBay are sending one of their customers into a convenience store, they're judging us and they're judging the retailer on the quality of the experience. It's not about the cost dynamics or sort of how cheaply I can do it. It's kind of what did that consumer think about the pickup experience and did it match up with, you know, the overall experience that I did from interacting with Amazon. So the game's changing, I guess, just in terms of expectation, both from the sector, but also in terms of the consumers that are interacting with stores.
Certainly in terms of consumers. Do you catch my eye?
Sorry, yeah, please, can I just make a point there? Expectations of the customer service that customers receive. When Amazon tell them to take a cooker or a mattress back to their local shop and they can return it, you can imagine the response they get.
I think my favourite's a surfboard.
Yeah. Your best customer service in responding to that, I'm sure. Do you catch my eye if anyone wants to ask a question of any of the panel? But I want to move on now with Linda to talking about a new service, which you have offered voluntarily on a trial basis, which is deposit return schemes, but which, quite possibly within 18 months, in all retailers in Scotland, or many retailers in Scotland, may have to provide, and in England and Wales into the future too. So, Linda, how's that experience of offering deposit returns facilities and services been?
It was very much an interesting social experiment, as much as anything, to see people's reactions to getting what they saw as free money. Because, of course, when we were doing it, nobody was paying a deposit. Mm. So all the money that they were getting back from the bottles that they were returning was coming out of our pocket.
And we did encourage them. That was going to a local charity, that's right.
Yes, we encouraged them to give it to our local school for a project. But, of course, we couldn't enforce that. And a lot of people, disappointingly, did take the cash. And we saw some of the best of human nature and we saw some of the real worst of human nature, and it was a real eye-opener. But generally, people loved the idea. And as I say, with the proviso, you've got to remember they were not initially paying the upfront costs, which they will be when it becomes live. They loved the idea because, number one, everybody knows we need to do something, and they thought it was great that us as a store, it certainly gave us a good reputation as a store for doing this, for being part of this trial. We got a lot of complimentary comments on Facebook and social media and personally as well. Secondly, people loved getting money back for something, and what we did find was that people would save up bags full of containers and bring them in and take out quite a lot at a time, so we had to put a limit on it because people were coming up to the till and I'll take a bottle of Smirnoff with my voucher. I mean, the one concern, which doesn't seem to concern the government at all, and touching on the earlier session, was we did find a lot of parents used it as pocket money for their children. There's 10 bottles, go and buy some sweeties. And our confectionery sales went like that, which we weren't too keen on, but again, there's nothing you can do about that.
And buy that with an ETA scheme, it'd be perfect. You'd see together.
Exactly, please. Yes, exactly. It's almost like it's a contradictory, two contradictory policies.
Yeah.
But there's some real major concerns about the costings of the scheme as it's been proposed. And I'll take you through the different steps. Initially, all producers of bottles, we're talking about bottles, cans and glass, which is another can of worms, so to speak, they will all have to pay a producer's cost. So every single unit they produce, they'll have to pay what we imagine at the moment is going to be 3 pence. So that's an initial cost every manufacturer, supplier will more than likely pass on to us, and we'll have to pass on to the consumer. So there's your first cost. And they'll have to register every single product that they sell in Scotland. And if it's not registered in Scotland, it cannot be sold in Scotland. So there's another potential pitfall when we get to border areas and also online sales. If people buy things online from out with Scotland and try to bring them back to a store. Also, when we go as customers, to the wholesaler or the cash and carry, or you do your online ordering, the cost of these units will be added onto your bill. So we did a cost comparison. We reckon that the average store will see their weekly cash and carry bill go up by about £1,000. So there's a cash flow issue for us right from the start. So every single case of Coke, for example, that you buy, a 24-pack of Coke, you're paying 24 times 20 pence at the cash and carry. Now, the customer comes, brings the product up to the till, pays the extra 20 pence. At this point, you have levied the 20 pence onto the customer. And also, at the moment, VAT, we don't know where VAT's going to come into this, whether it's going to be inclusive or exclusive of VAT, because HMRC are still in discussion. So the customer pays their extra 20 pence. Now, they're not going to like that much, especially if they're buying multi-packs. So we imagine that we're going to see a shift away from multi-packs to larger bottle formats. For example, a 12-pack of Coke, again, is going to go up by £2.40. A 2-litre bottle of Coke will only go up by 20 pence. So that we're going to see shifts in what people buy. The cost of a reverse vending machine, which is what we trialled, is approximately £3,000. Now, we're anticipating that will vary a lot because hopefully buying groups will get together, symbol groups will get together and do deals with the manufacturers. There may be leasing deals available. The three stores that did the trials in Scotland averaged 220 units per day returned. Now, at that rate, the 3 pence per unit rate, which is what the Scottish Government would be paying a store with a reverse vending machine, that brings a revenue in of £2,500 a year, if you're assuming that volume of recycling. So there's a shortfall there. Plus, we didn't have glass at all in the scenario. Glass is problematic because you're going to have to immediately get a much bigger machine. It's almost twice the size. So you've got floor space in the store. 90% of store staff are female. Now, I would not like to be carrying big bags of glass, emptying the machine, which is going to have to be several times a day. And then, where do you put your empties? Because remember, these are worth a lot of money. You can't just stick them out the back because they're targets for theft.
They're returned again.
Yeah, exactly. So, we rented a container to actually store our empties in until the recyclers could come and pick up the recycling. Now, so we need to have a very immediate uplift system in place because we just don't have space.
Yeah.
Space is really expensive and can't afford space for empties.
Especially not space for dirty packaging.
Exactly. Yeah. And of course, you've got all the hygiene issues as well. Staff costs, cleaning the machine. The machine needed cleaned 4 to 5 times a day because there's always residue in bottles. And as careful as people are, there was stickiness around the machine, there was stickiness on the floor. That's another factor. And at 14 pence per minute, you've got to factor in your staff's time. Cash flow is a big problem. As I said, initially, you've got your costs at the cash and carry when you're making your purchases. You've got your cost of your RVM if you decide to buy one. How long is it going to take for the government to reimburse us for these bottles as well? Because ultimately, we will be reimbursed all the 20 pences plus the 3 pence handling fee, but we don't know how efficient that's going to be. There's also issues of bottles that may be rejected for various reasons. I know if you think about the similar system that we have with Menzies and WH Smith returns, getting your money back for your returns, just sort of magnify that many times over. There is going to be an exemption for stores. Small stores may apply to be exempted if there's a store in the area which has a machine, so they can apply to be exempted, which might be an answer for some stores. However, if you do have an exemption, you're going to lose the footfall.
Yeah.
Manual handling is possible, but again, space. I think
assuming hygiene issues as well and safety and stuff.
Of course you do.
Well,
yeah. I mean, do you reject bottles because they're dirty or sticky? Do you have to take everything? There are just so many issues, customer-facing issues, that just haven't been considered. Glass is only worth £5 per tonne. So it's very, very controversial that the Scottish Government has decided to include this. Every stakeholder in this process is against the inclusion of glass, including Viridor, who are the ones who will be ultimately recycling it. And at £500 and £1,500 per tonne, respectively, for the other kinds of container, it just makes no sense to include glass. And it makes it just so much more difficult. And as yet, we have no scheme administrator appointed, so the timescales just they are fantasy.
So there's a lot we don't know, but a lot we do know
exactly
about the retail impact, so
yes,
really
exactly.
Excellent to have a first-hand account of how that's been. Richard, I think that's a very much a retail perspective on some of the challenges of offering that service, which we may be mandated to do. What are you seeing in terms of consumer attitudes to recycling and these sorts of schemes? How much of a priority do you hear back from consumers as a this sort of approach is going to be?
So, I mean, environmental issues and sustainability is something that's going up and up in terms of consumers' consideration, in terms of what products they buy, how they buy them, what sort of factors influence what they buy. I think just in relation to this, the key consideration from our perspective, although we haven't looked at this issue, would be the impact on the customer experience.
Yeah.
We've talked about stores taking on other services and what that might mean in terms of the impact on the customer experience, whether that's queue times, whether that's knowledge of staff, appearance of store, all of those things would need to be considered. And if they have a detrimental impact on the customer experience, the quality of service they're getting from the store, I think that's what would be the immediate feedback from consumers. And I don't know whether that would outweigh the benefit they would see from using the scheme.
Sure. I'm still looking around for any questions. If anyone's got a question, we're going to move off deposit return schemes now, but I'm sure Linda's happy to relay all those experiences as well afterwards. So I'm going to finish with a closing question. I'm going to go to Steve, then James, then Richard, then come back to you for last word, Linda. And I suppose we sort of touched on that a bit already, but I need to sort of place a bet, back a horse, in terms of a service that we're going to see more of, substantially more of in the convenience sector in, let's say, 5 years' time, 10, 15 years, who knows, might all be hit by the meteorite by then, but might have got Brexit done by then. But so next 5 years, Steve, what do you think?
If I was placing my bet, it would probably be home delivery. So there's a kind of a, my dad used to bore me endlessly about his first job as a delivery boy on a bike for a local greengrocer's and sort of, you know, the sort of going through wind and rain to sort of, you know, get products to the local community. And I know you often bemoan the fact that sort of if a national newspaper's writing about the convenience sector, they pull out a photo of Ronnie Barker. But actually, I think Granville's back with a vengeance, basically. So we've seen little bits of it with some of the things that have been happening with things like Deliveroo and I know some of the cost models there are sort of challenging just in terms of the sort of, you know, the percentage that those guys take. But then looking at, say, people like Mo Razak, who sort of, you know, kind of has taken it upon himself to do his own version of it and sort of, you know, kind of and how that's kind of working. So I think that's a sort of an emerging and sort of interesting bet. And I think the sort of the accompanying thing with that, I think there is an opportunity there, just in the way that something like Just Eat has sort of effectively not killed takeaways. It's just put a sort of a digital layer on the top of it and made me even lazier as I sort of ordered my Chinese on a Friday night to do it from an app. They're still in business. It's still that local business delivering to me. They're cooking the food and they're bringing it to me. But actually, kind of, it's just making it even more accessible. So what's the convenience, Just Eat?
Sure.
You know, I think that could go hand in hand with that sort of home delivery model, just in terms of sort of what consumers have an appetite for.
Yeah, fascinating. We're on real balance there between that, the commercials as they are operating that versus the potential access to lots of new customers and in tune with customer lifestyles. James, I suspect it might be more relating to finance, but maybe not. Maybe you've got a different view about convenience stores and services in the future.
I was using my 1 minute there to see if I could come up with something really left field, but pass. Of course, I think, you know, actually, the convenience stores are going to become the hubs for cash, particularly over the next few years. They are going to be central to continuing to provide access to those people that rely on it. You know, of course, that has to make sense from an economic perspective. I absolutely hear Linda, and, you know, the challenge has been laid to the banks to make that happen. You know, and there are problems to solve, like making it secure and making convenience stores want to offer that service because it's good for their bottom line, it's good for footfall, it's good for their customers. But I think that's where the opportunity lies, and hopefully when we finally got a kind of stable government, we'll have a bit of leadership in this area and can pave the way to that.
Yeah, great. Richard?
Again, I've tried to use 2 minutes to try and think of something left field. I mean, I can't look really beyond what James has said in terms of where we're likely to go in terms of the in terms of cash and the onus being on retailers. If you look at some of the trends in the last couple of months in terms of the move towards cashback and cashback now being seen as the alternative, whereas the post office might have been seen as the alternative, we're now seeing dangerous signs that cashback is now seen as the alternative without necessarily any evidence to show that that's what consumers actually want or how they'll respond to that as an alternative. More broadly, I mean, I'll come back to my original point, and it is slightly left field. It's the sort of the personal service establishments, the personal services that consumers will need that they can't get anywhere else, whether that's provided in a convenience store, whether it's provided in another establishment alongside it, in a local community. They're the ones that, you know, will most likely survive and potentially continue to thrive.
Yeah. Great. Linda, last word.
I definitely echo that. I think people still want to speak to people. We're in a very digital age and people love online, but people still like to speak to people face to face. But I also think that parcels are going to go exponentially because of the devastation in the high street. We're losing more and more department stores, and there will be no other way to buy a lot of these items. So I think parcels is going to grow again.
Parcels. I mean, really good discussion. Some of the stuff I've taken out of that, certainly that strategically, the convenience sector really sits in a great place to provide a broadening range of services. It's how do we do that practically, whether it's about practicals of commercials, whether it's about the practical issues that Linda's talked about in terms of offering deposit return schemes and other services like that. But I think surely in terms of services, much more opportunity than threat for our sector. So with that, please thank the panel.